Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this edition of City Talks. Today, my guests are Harry Gerritsen, Professor of International Economics and Business at the University of Groningen, and Janke Stoker, Professor of Leadership and Organisational Change at the University of Groningen. They, along with some colleagues, are the authors of a brilliant and fascinating paper entitled The Relevance of Personality Traits for Economic Geography, Making Space for Psychological Factors. And this is going to be the subject of today's conversation, at least the start of the conversation. I'm sure we'll go on to other things. Harry and Janke, welcome to City Talks.
Thank you.
So I suppose the first question or first issue is, why psychology and economic development? I mean, in a sense, why bring those two disciplines together? What were we looking to achieve, or what were you looking to achieve by doing that? Janke, do you want to start us off on that?
Yeah, maybe the economist should start with this. But I want to, yeah, so I can start. So I think in general, we see the two fields of economics and psychology, and maybe also geography, getting closer together than they used to be, mainly because we want to explain phenomena or find explanations for things that happen in the world. And it's hard to find good explanations if you only cover them coming from one discipline. So I think that what we did in this paper might stand for a larger development we see in the in those fields, where we see that economics and psychology have a lot to offer to each other, not only in how we explain certain outcomes, but also in the way how we study them. And that's what we try to do in this paper as well.
Yeah, and particularly, I guess, when we're trying to explain or look at, you know, complex issues related to urban and cities, which by themselves are very complicated. Harry, you could just give us a sense of what's the bringing together of these disciplines?
Yes, so I think if you look from, I'm an economist, so if you look, and I did a number of years, I've done research on urban and regional issues, and also with other data sets for the UK, for instance. But the thing is that we as economists always look, if you look at explanations, typically look at the kind of a high level of aggregation. So if you look at why one city is doing better than the other, it's about city A has a different specialization structure, more human capital, it's physical geography one way, it's just a harbor or whatever. But those things we not only research, teach our students, but they're kind of, they're on a system level, they're on the level of the city predominantly. And if we dig deeper, we're willing to go to the firm level, obviously. Increasingly we look at firm level data, but actually to look at what might drive individual behavior of people that live in a certain area and why this might matter to explain economic differences, or differences in economic outcomes, is quite novel. But as Janke was saying, I think it ties up with, or ties in with, the work for instance by people like Kahneman in behavioral economics, that increasingly economics will recognize that we should pay more attention to behavior. And when applied to cities, I think it's I think there's also a very pragmatic reason, because those standard explanations, so your specialization structure, your level of human capital, in the case of the UK, whether you're close or not close to London, all those things matter up to a point.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things are unexplained for. And I think, also from a pragmatic point of view, we were just curious also, not just because of fields we're coming together, but also we're curious, but if we would act psychological factors, and we come to that, how we measure this, but whether it could add or be not so much be a substitute, but it has value added over and above. We're not denying all those other things matter.
No.
So it's not a competition, but then we get new insights by including those factors. But so, and there's another, maybe the last reason, that in geography, people talk a lot about culture. So there's even a cultural turn in geography. People, years ago, so the role of culture and how this might be relevant to explain regional or urban differences, so differences in growth paths or employment paths. But deep down, if you think hard about it, we think that culture is ultimately the result of norms and values of individuals collectively, for this collective outcome of individual expressions. So why not then go one level deeper, and instead of having a cultural measure, and they exist, by using European value survey studies, we have regional value outcomes on for regions and cities, but of course deep down they're the result of what people think and do, and what their objectives are. So by trying to dig deeper, we thought, as an economist, and then ultimately you're faced with somehow you have to engage with psychology, whether you like it or not. So, and I think that's what we did in this paper, greatly helped by the fact that one of the co-authors is Jason Renfro from the University of Cambridge. He has been around this topic longer than the two of us, so he has been, I think, for more than 10 to 15 years for a number of countries, has collected these big five personality traits data for loads of individuals, so over 400,000 people for the UK, but also for other countries. And until kind of our paper and one or two twin papers by, for instance, Neil Lee from the London School of Economics, and also work that Andres Rodriguez Pose has been doing, I think they're more like, so far it's been more like correlational type. So there are associations between certain type of personality traits and health outcomes or economic outcomes, but it's kind of begging for what's causing what, right? So, and I think that's why we also try to make.
Yeah, no, of course. And I think we'll get to that, because I think there's when you start to read through the paper, which is brilliant, not least because it prompts you to think about something, which you then subsequently answer, which is fantastic. But the first one I think is, are we talking about culture, but just using different terms? And then you begin to unpack that. And then it's going to, which way round is this going? And actually, what's causing what? So, Jagger, just for the purposes of those, like myself and many others, unfamiliar with the sort of psychology literature, just you talk about the big five.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what the big five is, where they come from, what sort of the literature is telling us about that, and what makes up the attributes of the five, and then we can get into the economy side and come back to how we applied it.
So the big five is something we more or less agree upon as psychologists, that these are five dimensions that can describe a person's personality. So the whole research on personality goes back a long way. But at a certain point in time, you could say, okay, we agree that these are five dimensions that make up a person and a person's personality at the individual level. Of course, what we do, but we will get back to that, is that that is also something that is regionally clustered. But the basic idea, of course, of psychologists was that it is something that it describes you and me as individuals. And these five dimensions are openness to experience, to whether you're open to new experiences and whether you're open for innovation and those kind of topics. Conscientiousness, so whether you're well organized. Extrovert or extroversion, so whether you're basically liking to interact with others and very open to tell everyone how you feel, etc. Agreeableness, which basically is whether you're nice and friendly, and neuroticism, which tells us something about your emotional stability.
Yeah.
And those five, in all kind of research and studies, has been shown that these are indeed five dimensions that kind of sum up your personality, and that by using these five, we can also describe people. Mm-hmm. And of course, after that, a lot of these personality traits, because that's how we call them, are linked to all kind of outcomes, right? So can we also use them as predictors, for instance, for individual outcomes, like how you, for instance, do your job or how you act in certain situations, but also for outcomes like health or for instance, it's a lot of things that we also study, so for instance, economic success or whatever, so at the individual level. And what you, of course, see, and that's also something that we did in our paper, is that you can say, okay, you have these separate dimensions, which you can see as predictors of outcomes, but you can also say, in the end, you're one person, so you could say this is also something that, in the end, is a configuration of these factors. And one of the things we study in our paper, and we labeled that entrepreneurship culture, like some authors before us also did, is that you say, okay, but if you have a combination of these five, and that means that, for instance, you score high on openness and conscientiousness and extroversion, and you score relatively low on agreeableness and neuroticism, that builds up to an entrepreneurship culture. So then you score high on this entrepreneurship culture, and that's the variable in the end that we used, which in the end makes you more than just being not so very agreeable or not so stable or very stable. But the combination of the five makes that you are kind of an entrepreneurial type.
And are the five So, you know, in the sort of literature, are the five present in every individual, and is it, and so that you're into shares and, you know, yeah, at the margins, and are they in conflict with each other, or you know, or are some clusters kind of good attributes and others clusters,
yeah, so,
you
know, yeah,
is neuroticism, yeah, clusters kind of bad?
Yeah, so this is a good question, because of course we psychologists don't like to talk about good or bad because this is just human beings, yeah, right? So you cannot say that being neurotic is bad, but what we do know is that being very neurotic is a predictor for all kind of unfavorable outcomes.
Yeah.
But to start with your first question, yes, everybody is a combination of this. Mm. So everybody scores on these five dimensions, but you can score high or low or somewhere intermediate. And what you see is that indeed, for instance, so what we do with the entrepreneurship culture is that you see that openness and conscientiousness, for instance, and extroversion are lumped together as personality characteristics that are somehow related to this entrepreneurship culture. So if you combine that with being not too friendly and also being not neurotic, that means that you're stable and you're going for new stuff and willing to take on risks, etc., yeah, which indeed you could say characterizes an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
So you see indeed these logical combinations, and of course what you can also say is that we have these kind of personality characteristics, for instance, that can predict success as a manager or success in all kind of jobs that relates to these personality characteristics.
Okay, and so you were able to, so you have the literature and then you have the data set, yeah, that relates to this literature. Yeah. Which is UK based. Yeah. Just say a little bit about that, and then Harry come in on the economic side, yeah, and say, how do we marry that with an economic, sure, development data?
Yeah, yeah.
How does that work?
Yeah. So the nice thing is that Jason Renfro, in collaboration with the BBC, was able to collect this huge data set of UK citizens, more than 400,000 UK citizens, and they were asked all kind of questions about their personality, but also about other questions, so how they were brought up and where they lived and how their health situation is and how satisfied they are with their job. So it was a load of questions. And what you see is that based on that, of course, these are 400,000 individuals, but we also know where they live.
Yeah.
And we know where they were brought up. Mm. And that means that, and that's also what Jason Renfro did, for instance, in the US, is that you can say, okay, but if we kind of cluster these individuals at a more regional level or at a city level, we can also see patterns of personality that are distinct from each other. Mm-hmm. So although you are an unique individual living in London or somewhere else, we can also say that people living in London have these kind of shared personality characteristics, yep, that are distinct from people in other regions or other cities. And mm-hmm. then, of course, it becomes interesting because then we can link them to economic outcomes, mm-hmm, also at these higher levels.
Yeah, great. Okay.
Yeah.
So, Harry, take up the story on... So we've got this big data set looking at these five, the big characteristics, knowing where people live and, you know, crudely the characteristics that they've got. What's the data set and the thinking on the economic development, economic performance side?
What we then, based on what Janker was already just told us, I think that we need two more ingredients. One is indeed economic data, but in kind of an intermediate step is also we first have to establish and also give some arguments why they should be clustered, right? So instead of having every person has a big five score, but instead of seeing a random distribution across whatever map you're drawing, the UK or Germany or the US, you see indeed regional clusters. And in the paper we've made some intention to make it say, well, it's reasonable to expect this because of migration, economic history that creates a certain background, because that's the old nature nurture type of discussion, mm-hmm, right? Sure. Mm-hmm. Partly it's your genes, yeah, but partly it's also the environment you grew up in, and that determines, I think in the literature, you will correct me, but in psychology, it's like your formative years, it's like between your fifth or 20th year, that's kind of where your personality is formed. It's not fixed, we come to that, but it's kind of stable. And of course, partly driven by your genes, but also by what kind of socioeconomic background, the city you grew up, the environment. If you grew up in an industrial town, it might have different implications, on average, right? So there are neurotic people everywhere, or very open people, but it's a distribution that differs, right?
Yeah.
So once we establish that, and that's really true for the UK, so for instance, as you might expect, openness to experience is a bit more predominant in big cities, like London. Not everybody's open to experience in the city, but on average, whereas neuroticism is a bit higher, and it's not meant in a judgmental way, again, in some old industrial districts in Wales or also in the north of the UK. So we see these patterns, and then we combine it with our economic data set. So in the sort of paper we're talking about, we focus on the 63 primary urban areas, because we already have this nice data set that's partly built by people like Ron Martin, who's also a co-author of the paper. And then say, wait, we have these outcome variables, employment, outputs for a long period, 1980 until more like now. And we have all those things that we know that matter, that we talked about in the beginning as economists, they matter to some degree, like the distance to London, kind of a market potential thing, the specialization structure, the age structure, levels of human capital across cities, whether you're a new town or not, so all these like more institutional differences. So we know that Milton Keynes or Reading are different, right? For reasons which are have a policy background, and so we include them as well, and first show that they matter. So that some of them, and they don't matter, not each and every one of them, but they, yes, they are to some extent relevant. And then we say, okay, and not just by just lumping in the big five, but based on theory, we think that based on what we know from also the relationship between individual traits and, for instance, individual job performance, that neuroticism and conscientiousness are probably of the ones of the big five, probably the most important ones initially, and also this combination that's called entrepreneurship culture, which is a mix of those five. And then we start to include them in our growth regressions very carefully by saying we do growth regressions just for all the regions, we do growth regressions as deviations from the national growth path, as you would do in this type of work, both for the individual traits, neuroticism, conscientiousness, and also for this mixed trade. And then we, something I'm going to talk about next, I think, is we deal with causality, but first, to our surprise, of course, we hope to find something, but the effects are quite substantial. So to give an idea that when you look at neuroticism, because it's one of the significant findings, that over from the 1980s onwards until now, so Grimsby is an area that scores quite high on neuroticism, all in relative terms, obviously. Mm-hmm. And you say, suppose they would swap places in terms of with a place that or the national average, or even one of the places that has a significantly that has one of the lowest neuroticism scores, like some London area or the southwest. Then, in terms of everything else being the same, then the output gap of Grimsby with the national average, not just London, but only already with the national average, would be over time be 25% lower.
Right.
So somehow, it's not like these results are statistically significant one way, but in size effects, it really, in cumulative sense, it matters what these scores imply, right? Yeah. Whether you buy the results or believe it's something else. But and the same for entrepreneurship culture. I think Telford is a region, so they don't score that high on entrepreneurship culture. I'm not trying. So for the Telford listeners.
No. The data on a bunch of other things would suggest that is true. You're not casting aspersions.
It's very hard not to be normative here. But
you're not casting aspersions on
come
that.
Come to that because one of the critiques we got, it's going to bring this, like it's this almost Darwinistic, we know it's social determinism, which it is not.
No.
Because I think the things we measure are the individual expressions what we as economists and geographers are always happy to acknowledge that culture matters. So culture is ultimately driven by the values of people and their actions and beliefs. One way to measure that is personality traits. So if you take that seriously, I think you can go down to the individual level. It's not fixed, it can be changed. Come to that. Telford, I was talking about Telford. So if they would switch to the entrepreneurship culture, which is kind of UK average or one of the better places in terms of entrepreneurship culture measures, I think again, that would mean over from 1980 onwards until now, would lead to a 30% lower output gap between Telford and what it is actually now and what it would have been with a higher score in entrepreneurship culture. So in a cumulative sense, incremental sense, these things matter, right? And that's also, I think, our main motivation to start thinking at the end of the paper why are these things somehow, can we think of interventions where these things might be changed or how fixed are these things we're going to talk about in a minute?
Okay, so you started to talk a little bit about the results, but and you said within that when you observe the distribution of the characteristics, mm-hmm. either you know entrepreneurial culture or yeah. The other two, that they do cluster yeah. in a sense. They're not randomly or evenly distributed across yeah. across space. So let's just unpack that, because mm-hmm. you cover it in the paper, but you know the immediate reaction, I'm sure listeners will come in as well. You know, you've got selection issues going
yeah,
on
of
there.
Course.
People are selecting yeah. in, or you're just simply talking about kind of long run social norms,
yeah.
which you know
yeah, yeah.
actually
yeah.
seem to have
yeah.
quite long effects, even though the,
yeah.
the originator has disappeared, yes. maybe industrial. So just unpack the, we see clustering. Why do we see the clustering,
yeah.
and what's the relative role now that social norms on the one
yeah.
hand and selection are playing on the other?
Yeah, so it's clearly a two-way street, right?
Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, you could say something, so personality is something that is specific to you, and it also relates to how you were brought up, and also you could say it's kind of, it has to do with your parents and how they were, etc. So it is an individual-based description, but mm-hmm. on the other hand, you are shaped, and your personality is shaped by lots more than just your genes.
Mm.
So, and the fact that is shaped means that you experience certain things throughout your life, but also that you experience your surroundings and where you grow up. And that's a lot bigger than only your family, for instance. So what you see is that indeed, for instance, the social surroundings or also your economic conditions can also shape your personality or shape whether you think it's normal to be open or whether you think it's good to go out there, or whether you think whether you are more introvert, for instance. So what we describe in our paper, and also what we try to find ways to solve this, of course, is if whether you can disentangle whether economic conditions cause personality or influence personality, or whether personality factors in the end also can be seen as predictors of economic outcomes.
Mm.
And what we try in our paper, at least we apply two ways to deal with this issue.
Yeah. So the first thing, so you mentioned the selection effects. So happily in our data, there's already a clue how to go about this, because we know that for the people that filled in the personality traits, we can make a difference. And we, given that we have so much data points, we can have the luxury that we can throw away something, right? Normally you're happy to keep all the data to get a significant regression, in a statistical sense at least. But here we can make a distinction with people that actually grew up in a certain place and people that moved there. So selection effects might be selective migration. You move to a certain place, consciously or subconsciously, because you like it there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe one reason might be because the people that live in the place that you prefer to move to, they kind of have the same psychological makeup, one way or the other, on average.
Mm-hmm.
So it feels like home or feels like a good place to live because it's a good match with who you are. So that's, of course, then causality goes the other way around. So, but in our data, we can also only look at people that were actually born in Telford,
yeah,
or where we know that already their parents were born in Telford, right? So we also have data, we got a question, did your parents already live here? And then the results are quite robust to that. So it's not, so we can address the selective migration point. That keeps the point because we have because the big five, ideally you would like to kind of have a time series on that
yeah.
as well, but we're already quite happy that between 2009 and 2011, the BBC funded this,
mm-hmm.
so thanks to the BBC. But I think colleagues like Jason Renfro and Martin Opshonka, who he works a lot with, they have been in related research recently shown that how these big five characteristics are not just related to the industrial heritage of the UK, because some of these scores relatively on neuroticism are relatively higher and openness to experience a bit lower, seem to be correlated with old industrial towns, as one might not expect. Of course, but then it's still what's causing what, right? So they go back and say, okay, but economic conditions were all already shaped by the people that lived there at that time. So it's again the dog and the tail type question, right? So they then have data on historic coal fields. So the physical geography, so that's fixed. Nobody could move that, right, where these coal fields were. And we know that these in the Industrial Revolution in the UK, they're kind of preconditioned where industrial towns, where industrial activity should flourish, right? Because it's, and then they say, okay, are these historic coal fields or the places next or close to historic coal fields, can we still see that there are certain personality traits, so that we're quite sure that causality there was from economic circumstances or preconditioning circumstances for industrial revolution, And still we see evidence that in those places, even though the industrial heritage, industrial activity as we know is long, everything has changed by now, but still there's a legacy that certain personality traits are still more predominant in those areas. So there are various ways to address it, and the way, maybe just to finish on that point, that we did in the paper was that because we were lucky to have the full data set, we had data for each individual. There was a question whether you had a traumatic experience in your youth, so in the period that your personality was kind of formed, like the death of a parent. Mm. And people filled in that question. Of course, that's a that's a huge traumatic experience. And then we checked that the degree to which this is traumatic, as might be expected, is not dependent whether you live in London in an affluent borough or whether you live in Telford.
Okay.
So you think that's clearly something that it has a very strong predictive value for how you turned out. So for instance, people, everything else being the same, that went through this terrible experience in their youth typically score higher later in life, or once you check their personality rates, higher on neuroticism.
Yeah.
But it's completely but the degree to which it's traumatic is unrelated to whether you grew up in an area with high or low unemployment, right? So that then we can use, say, well, let's first use this traumatic experience because it can help us to explain personality traits. We are quite sure this has nothing to do with economic conditions. And then the part of personality traits that's linked to this traumatic experience, if we see that as a predictor of economic circumstances, we're quite sure that causality is less likely to go two-way because we've kind of excluded the possibility. We only look at that part of personality traits that's linked to this traumatic experience, which we call in modern jargon an instrument variable. And so to use these methodologies, also I think you can apply them for the very obvious question that we got, that people rightly ask us, for example, it's a two-way street, yes, but if you have if you're lucky enough to have the right data, you can do something about it that makes you a bit more sure that we were right in putting personality traits on the right hand of our regression model and economic outcomes on the left hand side.
Yeah, and get your thoughts in a second, Yanker, on, because I'm always intrigued and somewhat surprised about the kind of longevity effects of previous conditions and how long they, you know, and so there's a transmission that's going on there, which I'd love to get your kind of thoughts on that, because you definitely see this in the work that we do as well. But just, Harry, you mentioned that, is there a noticeable difference, notwithstanding your points about, you know, traumatic experiences, is there a noticeable difference in a place at the characteristic level between people who move there and people who stay?
Well, the people that move there, we see that people that move there actually typically move to areas that kind of fit their person. So there's some self-selection going on. So if you look at it as a distribution, because in any place there are people that score high and open to experience, in any place there are neurotic people, so it's always a mix. But typically you see that if you look at the distribution of a certain place, that the people that move there are more like the average, because they fit in. So one reason why people move to certain areas, well, job prospects, might be many things, but certainly also it has something to do because you feel that could be a good place to live, because you feel that it could be a good surrounding, you like the people, get on with. And that's deep down, of course, might be a result because those, on average, you encounter on every street corner, you're more likely to encounter people that kind of are similar to you than if you would move to a different city with different whatever personality traits.
That's interesting. Okay. Transmission through the decades or through the through the generations. What's the psychology literature, or you know, what's your reading of that? How does that happen?
Are the mechanisms? So I would say that so on the one hand, at the individual level, and that's of course what you see with this traumatic life experience, is that you see is that the experiences you have, especially during your childhood, kind of form your personality, right? At the individual level. So one of our policy implications also relates to this, with that you say, okay, if these personality traits then are so important, but also are malleable, so it's not something you start off with in life, but it can be changed and developed, then you could say that it's important to pay attention to the development of these kind of skills that relate to personality, maybe even more so than relate to cognitive skills, because it really helps you later in life. Right, so at the individual level, I would say that what you see is that the development of personality traits is something that is important for individuals, and it is also something that you can change throughout your early years in school, and even before school.
Yeah, yeah.
So well, that's at the individual level, right? And you could say that at the more at the higher level, so whether you talk about cities or regions or maybe even countries, of course, there you see that. And then I think I would label it more as culture than as maybe only personality traits. Is that you can see that this is something that is, well, also quite consistent, but also can develop, right? So, for instance, what you see is that a lot of people in the field of culture and cultural differences between countries have distinguished some kind of characteristics of culture, like power distance, which is a dimension that relates to how much we feel it's normal that there is this power hierarchy and difference between people. Mm. And you see clear distinctions between, for instance, countries. Mm. And that relates to what we feel is acceptable in, well, how we work or what working conditions are or what the hierarchy is within society. Mm. And I would say that these kind of cultural dimensions develop quite slowly, or on the other hand, you could say are quite consistent throughout the years, and they relate to, I would say, culture and how we share. How we share norms and values, which is it's at a higher level. So it relates to personality, but it's also something that you share at a higher level.
High level. Yeah. It's more like a stock and like in many variables, you can say there's always a stock and a flow dimension. Mm. So the stock at a higher level kind of for a certain region, I would say the stock of personality traits or the distribution is quasi fixed.
Yeah.
So it changes, but very slowly.
Yeah.
But doesn't necessarily have any predictive value for an individual. So there's lots of in and outflows. So if you, even two people growing up in the same area that has a certain distribution of personality traits or in certain averages can turn out to be, luckily, right, because otherwise it's social determinism, can turn out to be very different in terms of the actual personality traits based on their education, their parents, the things they encounter in their childhood or their early adulthood. So the transmission, so on a system level, things change. There's a lot of, like with unemployment, right? So the stock can be fixed. The actual people being employed at any snapshot moment is very different. It's the same with personality traits. So yes, you're bound by history, but luckily as an individual, that doesn't necessarily determine your destiny, right?
No.
Now, and the question would then be, I would say, for policy is whether you can, but via policies that try to somehow intervene with these regionally clustered personality traits, whether you can use policies to, well, get people more open to experience or get them more entrepreneurial, right? And I think that's something that we haven't tried yet in policy, because of course this is a new way of looking at how personality traits at a regionally clustered level might impact economic growth or employment, for instance.
Yeah.
So at the risk of being saying something which is like hereditary, is saying traditionally regional policy is aimed at whether you do it via the carrot or the stick, right? Is aimed at existing firms and at people already have jobs or you would like to have better jobs, right? And fair enough, right? That's what we as economists are trained to do. This kind of signals that you should maybe do something in terms of policy intervention at a much earlier age. By not thinking in terms of subsidizing regions, or is it the only, but think about totally different things, right? Maybe investing much more in certain areas by giving young people much more in terms of experiences. So investing a lot more in showing them, bring them in contact with entrepreneurs, or saying let's go abroad, let's go or whatever, and whatever they do with it is something else. But actually, the probability that maybe, if you do it on a large enough scale and consistently, that you might change people's experience.
Absolutely. We've done some work recently looking at education and skills performance across the 63 urban areas, that we look at. And what you observe is that obviously the performance at set points in the education system, or in the skills profiling of different, varies quite markedly. Some places very good, some places kind of not so good, which then leads you to think about how you might deal with some of those sort of questions, or what some of the factors that you might want to try and influence. And often, as I think both of you are saying, the traditional response is to go down the supply side, which is to say, well, you know, the courses on offer are not sufficiently attractive. Sure. Yeah. If we offered better courses, people would just simply take them up. And I think, as I certainly think, you know, it's a bit more to it than that. And but also, interestingly, the work that we did, for example, showed that the participation in extracurricular activities in the schooling system, so it's not a kind of classic you know, school-based, class-based stuff, but actually participation in extracurricular is actually weaker in places where educational, more classical educational performance is weaker. And so but we know that participation in extracurricular gives you some of the gains, personality gains, maybe, or characteristic gains that fit you well for the future, whatever the future might be. So thinking about how you can improve educational performance and skills performance through maybe extracurricular is as important as saying we need better teachers, right? We need better teachers or smaller classes. Yes, that's probably true, but it's more to it than that.
Yeah, it's also about adaptation. So it's so the supply, well, in terms of phrasing it like this, I think, so the demand side of so it's the willingness or the of people to take up courses or the adaptation or the is as important. So if they have the right skill set in being willing, sounds from a pedagogical point of view, I think very straightforward in a way. It's as important as just saying, well, here are the courses and you can subscribe and good luck with it. I think it's also about that people must be trained earlier on in life, already being open and willing to learn, and that bring them in contact with people that have different experiences as well, I think is very important. Not just for the for the regional growth or whatever, but also with other changes that go on in society. So I think we've been talking now for like 50 minutes, and it must be a national record. We haven't mentioned Brexit at once yet. So here we go.
You did it. You're not. Yeah, exactly.
The dam has been burst. So you know, you go.
So I think because we kind of did a twin paper that we mentioned. You mentioned in the beginning, where we used the same underlying basic data set, but we looked at Brexit, which you can think is as an kind of exogenous shock to individual citizens in the terms of that referendum was held. And there we also checked controlling for a host of other things. We know from also research at the Center for Cities has done, there's a link to education, how people voted, there's a link to city size, there's a link to loads of things and to unemployment levels and whether you are, and London voted differently than lots of regions in the Northeast. Those things are well understood and all true, but here we also were intrigued by one fact that if you look at some regions, so it is more like local authority district level, but it kind of includes the viewers as well, obviously, that regions that trade the most with the European Union, you could say, well, as an economist, I would say that in terms of pure economic self-interest, would have most to lose from actually leaving the European Union. Predominantly, not all of them, but the majority of them voted in sometimes very large numbers, percentage-wise, for leave. And we started to think, as a could that be linked to, so could that partly be explained by looking at personality traits data? And there we very significantly, I think, have the result that openness to experience. So the basic idea, whether something like the European Union or more broadly globalization, change, technological change, whatever big systematic change, is it seen as an opportunity or a threat, right? That's what this trade part kind of signals. And in regions where open experience is quite low for whatever reason, again, not in a normative sense, no, that's not the part, that's not the aim of the analysis, obviously, is that we show that those regions, controlling for all those economic conditions, that those regions that predominantly voted leave score very low on openness to experience, whereas you can see flip side regions which score high on openness to experience predominantly voted remain. Because maybe those people that score high see the European Union, not in every respect, but basically as an opportunity and not so much as a threat. So here too, you could think of, and it's not explained, it adds to the puzzle, right? So it's not, we're not claiming that it replaces the other arguments, but it's another example where insights from psychology could be used to just, well, not solve, but we just let's be more humble, by understanding what goes on in the real world by big events like Brexit.
Yeah, and so, yeah, in terms of, I mean, we talked a little bit about, in terms of the policy, you know, if the ambition of our our policy on the economic side is to improve the economic prosperity of the place and the individuals within it. What does the psychology literature, you know, in your understanding, what does that have to say about if that's our goal? So it's not just about making people, you know, more rounded, you know, whatever that might be, better individuals, but actually there's a kind of economic objective. Where would we look and what would we think about?
Yeah, so what I would say is that linked to our findings, and for instance, this whole entrepreneurial culture as a predictor of economic outcomes, you could say that, and I think we touched upon this before, is that the investment in cognitive skills, what we kind of seem to focus on always, well, it is important, but what, of course, these kind of studies show is that if you really want to pay attention to the development of personality skills, that might even be a better, in the end, have a better result than all these cognitive skills. And of course, they are important. But what you see is that you can develop things that relate to personality or the combination of personality dimensions, like in this entrepreneurship culture, that in the end might help you to become more effective once you're a grown-up. Mm. So that means that I think what our findings show, and of course what also other studies show, is that if you really want to target or aim for developing personality factors or characteristics, then that should be done early in life age. Yeah. And this is something that you can do preschool or during school, and that relates also to what you're saying, that that's not only teaching students or people at the age of 4 or 5 cognitive skills, but especially pay attention to personality. So giving them new experiences, making them more, trying to get the topic of emotional stability on the agenda, for instance, right? So our finding on neuroticism, and again, we're not judging people who score high on neuroticism, but we know that being neurotic is not a very good predictor for all kind of outcomes. So that means that getting people to become more emotionally stable is something that can be very helpful once you enter the job market.
I think we're already in some fields, we kind of are basically policymakers kind of acknowledge that these lines of argument make sense when we look at health outcomes, right? That's kind of accepted. That if you in terms of your lifestyle and how you deal with stress and how you that is related to health outcomes. I think nobody debates that, and that's something that can be, we think that can be through interventions also early in life, that schools pay attention to that, and how you should in terms of healthy food and how, well, I don't have to go through it. It's also in the UK. Only look at Jamie Oliver, and that's going to be cool, but I think that's just one example, right? But I think we are less accustomed to think in terms of that also some of these things might also apply into economic outcomes. I think that's maybe the novel thing, that kind of things that we find already acceptable, that you think that might be relevant for all kinds of social, economic, or indeed health outcomes, or whatever type of outcomes later in life, might also have a bearing on economic outcomes. And we as economists kind of say, well, it's fine for health. But we kind of feel a bit wobbly. We think, maybe we should move into that area a bit more as economic policymakers, because those things actually might be quite relevant.
And are you optimistic in that space?
Yes.
You know, as an economist, you know, I'm going to ask Jagger the same question as a non-economist. Economics itself, right, is going through a soul-searching exercise period where it's like,
in a narrow sense, I think it's helpful for economics as a discipline as well, because it takes all kinds of behavioral aspects more seriously, and not just by studying them, but also in thinking through possible implications. So that would help. I think that would be a big bonus for the dismal science, right? Point taken. And the second thing, I think it helps more generally actually for all kinds of policy questions, that economic policy questions that we actually face, not just as economists, but in as society at large, where I think that thinking more in terms of developing personality skills, or how we could, whatever resources we spend on urban or regional policies, that in the mix of things we're doing, I'm not arguing that we should stop doing what we...
No.
No. It's more like that in the mix of what we're doing, we might start to think a bit more, not saying subsidizing existing firms or people that come to you with a good idea or trying to improve the human capital levels of existing workers in a certain backward region, fine, let's try that as well. But also thinking more in how we could, with people younger, really young people, by changing their, without telling them what to do, it's not that you should become an entrepreneur, but increasing the chances that their personality traits, maximizing the chances that they end up with personality traits that somehow, on average, will fit them better in life. Than I think if in those terms, I think we could learn a lot also as economists.
Yeah.
And I would say Heckman is an economist, right? And
James Heckman, yeah.
He was already having this idea for decades ago, I would say.
Yeah, James Heckman has an old, so we can't comfortable with that, as long as we talk about, as long as it within the school system. But okay, well, let's assume that later in life, those things matter also for economic outcomes, not only on the individual level, we can't help with that, but on the regional level as well.
Yeah.
So we have to maybe get acquainted a little bit to that, but I think it's a fruitful area.
Okay,
are you optimistic that the dismal science of which we are part, you know, is open to new ideas as it goes through its kind of soul searching?
Yeah, so at an individual level, for me personally, I now have the experience that you can fruitfully work together. But at a more societal level, so I think, we should have reasons to be optimistic, because otherwise why do research or why try to find new ways how to improve in this case, like economic outcomes, but you can talk about all other outcomes as well. And I think that what I really like about our study is that you can also, so yes, it relates to personality, and you can say personality is something that is, well, it's not completely fixed, but it relates to individuals. But on the other hand, what we show is that, of course, you can learn people to deal with their personality skills and also to develop them. And of course, we know that you can learn behaviors, but the good thing, I think, also with these focus on personality skills is that although it might sound that it is something that you get when you're born and you're forever neurotic as of day one, well, the good thing, of course, what we show is that, or not only we, but what research shows is that these kind of personality traits are malleable and are changeable throughout things you experience, especially, of course, during childhood or your formative years. And we know what those formative years are. So that means that if you talk about policy or education, that there is something you can do. Also at more than the individual level, but at the regional level, or at the city level or neighborhood level.
Where next for this? I mean, for this sort of area of investigation and, you know, the combination of psychology on the one hand, economics on the other, and geography on the other. I mean, just give us, where do you see this kind of area going next?
I think we hopefully, there's sort of the kind of a label around it called this geographical psychology. I mean, labels always help. I think so. This is only one study. I hope that other people, in terms of replication, I hope to see similar studies also for UK, but also, of course, for other countries. So let's see how robust this is. And so there's one obvious, not very ambitious, but very necessary thing to do. And I think what I would like to see is that we would like to not just repeat this analysis in the sense that other people are doing it for different settings, but also over time, see if indeed things change. And by actually start to think about intervention. So could this really, I don't think we have to wait 20 years if we take this literature where this is coming from, like James Heckman, seriously. I think we already know enough in a way, we are already on firm footing, that we could try to think in terms of regional policy to do more in terms of policy initiatives that kind of are leaning in towards, or actually explicitly targeted towards changing personality skills, or at least trying to do that. And then, of course, we have to wait a bit, we have to be patient, because young people, and then track that. And maybe it could give us a very fresh perspective on not just understanding where certain areas differ and for long periods of time, but also how this is not destiny, but also how this can be changed. Yeah. And I think I'm quite optimistic that this will be not just a fruitful new research area, because of course we're preaching to the converted here, because that's what we continue to do. But I also think, I hope that it makes inroads in policy making as well.
So I agree. So I think that what you see is that, at least for instance in the Netherlands, in the region where we live, which has its own problems related to for instance, gas and stuff like that. But what you see is that we try to also invest there in entrepreneurship activities, right? So we try to teach children at school that it's a normal thing to do, to become more entrepreneurial, mm-hmm. and to take risks and to go out there. And I think that that's what we see is now happening. And one thing I think research should do is indeed follow those kind of interventions and also see, okay, does it really matter then? Does it help to try to develop these kind of skills with children and with young children that relate to these personality aspects as measured by entrepreneurship culture, so that we in the end can show that not only that it's important, which we now have shown, but also that it indeed is possible to develop these kind of entrepreneurship culture-like profiles of children, which in the end will help them become more effective once they're grown-ups.
Mm-hmm. Lots to think about, lots to do. My guests today have been Harry Garretson and Janka Stalker. Thank you very much for being part of City Talks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner. Used with permission, and all rights are reserved.